becomes the Grail King. And while the ceremony is taking place, people realize that this pagan here, he can't see the Grail. All he can see is the beauty of the girl who's carrying it, whose name is Réponse de Joie. And they say, what does he need? We'll have to baptize him. And I thought, good God, is Wolfram going to let me down here at the end of this story? So, here's the description of the baptism. An old priest who has converted many pagans comes in with a baptismal bowl that has not made of rubies and all this kind of thing. There's no water in it. He tips it toward the Grail, lapis axillis, the alchemical stone, and it fills with alchemical water. And then he baptizes Fairface. But before the baptism, Fairface says, what's going on here? What are you doing? They say, we're going to make a Christian out of you. He says, what does that mean? They say, well, it means that you renounce your God and accept our God. And he says, is your God her God? They say, yeah, I accept your God. I renounce her. So then, when he's baptized, there appears an inscription on the Grail. And the inscription says, and this is a very important statement, date is 1215, if any member of this company, by the grace of God, should become the ruler of an alien people, a foreign people, as he was, let him not speak of his lineage, and let him see to it that they gain and are given their rights. As far as I know, that's the first time this turns up in the literature of the world, that the rule is for the rights of the people. Well, you may say, well, there was Magna Carta in England in 1210, but Magna Carta was a statement by the barons requiring the king to give them their rights. This is a very different show. Now, the marriage of Potiphar and Condoleamours was not celebrated by any priest. The sacrament of the marriage was their love, and marriage was the confirmation of love. And that idea broke the polarity of marriage and love in the Middle Ages. Now, our ideals, both for love and marriage and for politics, are announced there for the first time, it seems to me. These are what really move the Western civilization. They really do. So for me, this is one of the great, great books of Europe. It's a beautiful book. It's been translated very, very well by two people whose names are Mustard and Passage. Curious combination. And I think it's published by the Vantage Press. It's in paperback. It should be easily to find. Wolfram von Eschenbach's Parzival. Well, after this, Parzival becomes the Grail King. Condoleamours, now with two little boys, comes as a lovely scene of the family reunion. And they lived happily ever after. And they lived happily ever after, you see. We got it together this time. The virtues of the knight, of the medieval knight, are temperance and courage and love and loyalty and courtesy. That's it. And these were the virtues displayed. So much for what I call for me, it's the greatest book of the Middle Ages. I would put it ahead of Dante, actually, because it deals with life and so on. And a great deal of information had come to Wolfram from the Orient. The Chateau Merveille was the one with the knights and ladies, was inspired by reports of the great caliph of Baghdad's palace in Baghdad, which then in the next century was destroyed by the Mongols who came crashing in. There are a number of other things that appear in Asian documents that Wolfram has brought into this book. You have to realize that this was the period not only of the Crusades, but also of Islam's conquest of India. Islam enters India in 1001 A.D. and finishes its job around 1565 A.D. Meanwhile, they're just conquering India, and there's a wonderful little story of a little princess whose name is... the name will come back in a minute. It's a Gita name or something, Sita Gita or something like that, who was the daughter of the king of Kanauj, and she was going to have a Svayamvara. In India, the Svayamvara is for nobles. When a young girl would reach the age of marriage, the father would invite the princes from all around, the eligible bachelors, to come and stand around, and she would place a wreath, a lei, around the neck of the one she chose. So the girl is choosing. This is an aristocratic game. Well, there was a young prince she wanted to marry, and his name was Prithviraj III, and her father didn't want him to be present, didn't invite him. And he had an image made of a monster and put it in the place where Prithviraj would be. And when it came to the Svayamvara, the girl put the lei around the monster. And at the same moment, what Shakespeare would call a sound alarums in the foyer, in comes Prithviraj and abducts the little girl and runs off. So this is one of the stories that was current at the time, and Fairfiz's Oriental consort is called Secundia and is an echo of that very little princess. So we have a lot of echoes back and forth. And now finally, for the other ground, this time we'll take very long on this, and then we'll have a little break, the Grail story of the quest of St. Graal, the Galahad story. I'm not going to go through it all. This is the one that you get in Mallory. It's the one that Mallory translated, but he omitted what seems to me to be the most important statement in the book. The knights were seated in the great dining hall of Arthur's palace, and Arthur would not let the meal be served until an adventure had occurred. An adventure did occur. The Grail was brought in by angelic carrier and hung above them, but it was covered with a veil, covered with a cloth. And then it withdrew. The whole company had been seated in amazement. After it had withdrawn, Gawain stood up and said, "I propose a quest. I propose that we should all go in quest of that Grail to behold it unveiled." And they determined they would do that. But then comes the lines that Mallory has omitted and which appear only in the old French text, and which, for me, epitomizes, gives the whole drift, you might say, of the Western European romantic and ideal of spiritual virtue. The text says, "They thought it would be a disgrace to go forth in a group. Each entered the forest at the point that he had chosen, where it was darkest and there was no way or path." When you're following a way or path, it is someone else's way. This is Europe at its best. And what you seek in life is the fulfillment of something that was never on land or sea, namely the realization of the potentialities of your own destiny and spirit and capacities and talents. And no one can do this for you. Now compare this with the guru principle that we're used to, where the guru knows where you are, what you should do next. There should be no criticism you're following. He'll give you his picture to wear. This is another story, a very, very different story. And that, together with what we got from Wolfram, seems to me to give the sense of this whole Grail world. When the spirit is ready, the Grail castle appears. But it is ready only when it has followed the dynamic of its own authentic living and spontaneity of spirit. So with that, I'd like just a break for about 15 minutes to freshen us all up. I see everybody sitting there. Then I'd like some questions, and we can ice cream now. This just gives an idea of the battle mentality of the time. As I said, it was serious. Every young man had to learn to handle these weapons. And instead of football games, there were these jousting tournaments, and people could get really hurt. Now, there's a knight riding forth with the war cry, Amar. Now, isn't that an absurd outfit? His heraldic sign was evidently the falcon or something of the sort. We know it's about love because you can see the roses, the flowers there. Now, how any husband shouldn't have known that there was a device like this in one of the towers of his castle, I don't know. But she's doing it very easily, and when you, if you know anything about pulleys, she's doing a big job there, bringing him up. Now, when a vassal took his vows to an overlord, the vassal would get down on his knee and hold his hands up like this. The overlord would take the hands, and then he would swear fealty and so forth and so on. The same game is played in the love game, you see. And the girl now is tying a knot to make sure that this vow is really going to hold. And then we come to the culmination, of course, with Merci. And there's his falcon there. Now I thought it would be amusing to run through a lovely little series of tiles in an abbey in London, in England, south of London, of Tristan, the Tristan story. And we've got them now in the black and white, so you can see what's going on here. This is Tristan playing the harp for King Mark. And I think in that period, no one would see that without thinking of David and Saul. And you really would. Those are the barons hoping that their children will not be given in tribute to Marhaut from Ireland. There is Mark kissing Tristan when Tristan leaves to give battle to Marhaut, wishing him well and so forth. This is Marhaut's sword coming down on Tristan's thigh, the poisoned sword. And this is Tristan's reply. The wound stinks. Isn't that great? Can you see? So that's Tristan in his little boat. That's Tristan giving harp lessons to Isolde. When you're reading Gottfried of this event, you realize that part of the model was the affair of Abelard and Heloise, which had taken place just a century earlier. 1118, I think, was the date of their meeting, where Abelard was Heloise's tutor, and they became lovers. And there's some beautiful letters of Heloise to Abelard after the calamity of their event later on when they were put in monasteries. This is the dragon. Unfortunately, the tile is broken, but there's the dragon. And here's Tristan riding at the dragon. And here, then, is the love potion. You know what that event is. That's the one of the ferryman who takes her out of the boat and falls on top of her. That's she with the hat. And this is the Tristan. And this is the Isolde coming to heal him at the end. So that's a little review of that story. This is the first kiss of Lancelot and Guinevere and the knight who introduced them to each other. The knight of the cart, Lancelot riding in the cart. He's going across the sword bridge. Going across the sword bridge. Now he comes to have her acclaim, and she just is cold. Very disappointing. Now we come to one more Arthurian romance. It's the last one, I think, of which for to have been put together. It's the story of Gawain and the Green Knight, and it dates from the 14th century. And it occurred in a manuscript in late medieval English, together with two other works, Gawain, Patience, and the Pearl. Here we have Arthur's court, and it was while they were at dinner like that one day that a green knight, a knight in of green color, a giant, riding a green horse and carrying a great big axe weapon, came in. And he challenged the court. He said, I offer an adventure. Any knight here to come down and cut off my head. And then, a year from now, meet me at the Green Castle, at the Green Chapel, and I'll cut off his head. Well, it's a curious kind of thing. Nobody was particularly eager to go down, but Arthur's court couldn't refuse the challenge. So Gawain picked it up, and Gawain goes down and takes the great big axe, cuts off the knight's head, and the knight stoops down, picks up the head, and says, see you in a year. Now, people were very kind to Gawain that year. And when the time came for him to set forth on the adventure, he did indeed set forth. There goes Gawain, and people are bidding him goodbye. Well, about 3 days before the appointment, he arrived at the house of a hunter. And he asked the way to the Green Chapel, and the hunter said, well, it's only a short way down the line here. Why don't you just stay with me and my wife for the 3 days? Get yourself in shape for this adventure. All right, said Gawain. Now he said, I'll be leaving tomorrow morning, that's the hunter said, to go hunting. I tell you, just stay here and rest up. And when I come back, I'll give you everything I shall have got during the day, and you give me whatever you will have got. Oh, that seemed all right. So the hunter went off. No sooner had he left in the morning than the hunter's wife came in, and you see her tickling Gawain's chin. She wanted to make love. Well, my heavens, with only 3 days to go, this young knight and the most beautiful, beautiful woman. But no, he said, I am a man of honor and of Arthur's court, and I don't betray my host this way. Well, she was terribly pressing and finally said, well, let me just give you one kiss. So he got a kiss from her. So when the hunter came home that evening and threw all his quarry on the floor, he gave that to Gawain, and Gawain gave him a kiss, and they laughed, and that was the day. So the next day, the hunter goes out, in she comes again, and is more pressing than ever, and Gawain is firm, and she gives him two kisses. So the hunter comes back with only half as much game, throws it on the floor, and he gets two kisses. Third night, the hunter goes out, the lady comes in, and she gives him three kisses and her garter. And she says, this will protect you against any harm. The hunter comes back, one smelly fox, throws this on the ground, gets three kisses, no garter. So the next day is the day of the Green Chapel. Gawain's ready. Gawain goes down the way, and as he's approaching the chapel, he hears a sound of somebody sharpening a blade. Sounds bad. And he comes, and here is the green giant. Green Giant says, okay, stretch your neck out. So he gets down and starts on. More, more, more. He lifts the axe and says, more. Just three times, you know. You're about to lose your head three times. Then the axe comes down. It just scratches him on the neck and he says, that's for the garter. This is the origin legend of the Knights of the Garter. And what it shows are the tests. These are the tests. Neither lust nor fear. He passed the lust test. He almost passed the fearless test. With just one little mistake. But do you realize those are the same two tests that the Buddha had to face? When he sat beneath the tree, the immovable spot, the lord of lust and death came and tried to move him. He prayed before him his three beautiful daughters. Their names were Desire, Fulfillment, and Regrets. And if the Buddha had been hanging on to himself as a separate ego, instead of already identified with the consciousness which was present also in them, he would have been moved. He wasn't moved. Then Kama, the lord of lust, turns himself into Mara, the lord of death, and throws at Gautama all the weaponry of his army. And again, there was no one there. And then came the third test to Gautama. Having failed as Kama, having failed as Mara, the tempter turns himself into Dharma, social duty. Now, isn't that the test of the Grail romance that we've just been dealing with? And he says, young man, whence this apathy? Haven't you read the morning papers? There are things to do in the world. And Gautama simply dropped his hand in the earth-touching posture, known as Bhumi Sparsha, earth-touching, and the goddess of the universe herself testified that he was eligible to be in that spot. The same tests. I think this is fascinating. There's the court seated with the grail appearing, carried by messengers. Now, Galahad had been introduced to them, this is the Galahad story, on the day of Pentecost as the coming of the Holy Ghost, so that the knight himself is the incarnation of the Christ power. Just as each one of us in the Buddhist tradition is the incarnation of Buddha consciousness. And we have to come to the knowledge of that. And in this Thomas Gospel, this Gnostic Gospel that has only recently been recovered, we read, he who drinks from my mouth will become as I am, and I am he. I am the all came forth from me. Split the stick, I am there. Lift the stone, I am there. Christ, Jesus is there speaking as the Christ, not as the historical person, but as the incarnation. And each of us must know himself to be an incarnation. This is the sense of these Arthurian romances, and this is the individualization. There's a little poem by a 17th century mystic who's called Angelus Silesius. The poem runs as follows. Of what use, Gabriel, your message to Marie, unless you can now give the same message to me?
No.
It's nice. There they set forth, and they're going to separate. That's Arthur in front. And each will enter the forest at the point that he had chosen, where it was darkest and there was no way or path. Now this is Sir Galahad and the Grail. That's one way of representing the Grail as a ciborium, such as holds the host in the Catholic Mass, in the benediction service. This is probably the proper form of the Grail as the original form in Cretan and so forth, as a bowl. This is a very curious representation on a 17th century window in an English church. This is interesting. This is in a church of San Lorenzo in Genoa. It is of green glass, but until it was broken in the Napoleonic period, it was thought to be a single emerald, a single enormous emerald that had been carved into a bowl. This was captured by the Genoese in the year 1001 in their siege of Caesarea in the Near East, and was brought back to Genoa. Now, around the edge is a little inscription which nobody has been able to read, but it's there. And this is probably the model for Wolfram's grail. The stone, it was thought to be a stone, an emerald stone, with the inscription that Fairfiz saw when he was baptized. And this is Wolfram von Eschenbach in his knightly regalia, and the pair of opposites, and we're going to go between. You see? Wolfram was a knight. He was a Bavarian knight. And when he describes a knightly combat, they are marvelous descriptions of those chaps. Really, this was heavy fighting with heavy swords. And there's some marvelous things where they decide to use the other edge of the sword. They toss the sword up and they catch it the other way down. And it was a kind of a virtuoso demonstration. Gottfried of Strasbourg, on the other hand, was a cleric. He was a clergyman. And he's very, very cynical with respect to knightly combats. And that comes out in the fight with the dragon, with the description of the dragon cutting a horse in half and all that sort of thing. Now I thought I'd end with another little story, the tarot cards. The tarot cards appear in the literature in the 14th century. Dante died in 1321. And by 1330, we're hearing sermons scolding people for playing cards. Why? Why should that not be recognized as a good thing to do? The earliest set of tarot cards dates from 1392. That's only the only earliest set that still exists. And that's only less than a century after Dante's death. So there's a lot of talk now about Egypt and gypsies and all that with the tarot cards. But if you take this set, which is the Marseille deck, which is the old traditional one, the whole thing is medieval. There are, as many of you know, two packs that are together in a tarot pack. One is of four suits, and the suits are the staves or batons, swords, cups, and coins. And what these stand for are the four estates in the Middle Ages. The swords are the nobility. The cups are the clergy, the chalice of the mass. The coins are the third estate, the money, people with money, trading people and so forth. And the staves are the serfs, or churls, the peasants. Now it's interesting, in our suits, we have four suits also. Clubs are still clubs. The sword, espada, is spades. The cups, the chalice, but ours are Protestant cards. You don't put the chalice on there. You, conscience, your heart is there. And instead of the coins, we have diamonds. So after the Reformation, we have clubs, spades, hearts, and diamonds. Now the number of cards in each suit is one more than in our set. You have the number cards up to 10, and I'm just giving one, two. And then instead of the jack, you have the knave and the knight and his attendant, and then the queen and the king. Now this is the set for the staves. This is for the coins, and the publisher of the set always gives his advertisement here, which is proper because these are the merchants, right? And then we go on to the cops, the clergy, and then the knights. Now you may wonder, how could it be that on the level of the serfs, one could get to be a king? Do you see? The point, wherever you have a society where the social order is fixed so that there's no social mobility, the virtues can be practiced on any one of those levels. And one can come to spiritual kingship as a peasant, as a merchant, as a priest, or as a knight. So what these cards represent then, these sets of cards that we're looking at here, are the modes of achieving spiritual kingship in the work of your social class. Now, the first function of mythology is to induct an individual into life in his society, and through that, into a spiritual kingship. But then there comes a second stage in life when the society disengages you. And as Jung says, the second half of life is concerned with the spiritual adventure. So the first half is getting you into the world and its wisdom through your participation in the society. And the second half is the inward journey. I found in India that these two aspects of images have been recognized. The local aspect, which has to do with the way myths and images are used in this society as distinct from that, is called deshi. And this simply means local or popular. But the local forms embody or enclose and enclose archetypes. The archetypes appear in different forms in different cultures, but they still are the same archetypes. There was an important German anthropologist, Adolf Bastian, the last part of the last century, and he noticed that in all cultures the same archetypes occur. And he called these elementar Gedanken, elementary ideas. But the elementary ideas appear in local forms in the different parts of the world and in different periods of history. And he called these Völkergedanken, or ethnic ideas. Now, the ethnic ideas enclose the elementary. And so you are introduced to the elementary ideas through the disciplines and rituals of your society. Then the society disengages you, or you disengage yourself. And the elementary idea is, as it were, unshelled. And this guides you then to yourself. And in the Hindu, in the Sanskrit, that aspect is called the marga, the path. Marga is from a root, mrg, which refers to the trail left by an animal. So you follow the trail left by the animal. And what's the animal? The human spirit. Then it carries you to your own inward heart. So this is the outgoing stage. And now we're going to come to the 22 cards of the honors deck. That's the second part of the tarot pack. These now are the ones I want to talk about. I was once lecturing at Esalen, this was a long time ago, and somebody asked me, what about the tarot cards? Well, I said, give me a pack and I'll go to my room and tomorrow morning I'll come out and tell you what I think. And when I began laying the cards out, first thing I noticed was these four. Here is a woman pouring water from a blue into a red vessel. Now, knowing medieval symbolism, this is pouring the energy of life from the earthly to the spiritual vessel. And this is called temperance. It's called temperance because when that happens, you may become inflated. You know, oh, I'm just spiritual. In some ashrams, you notice this. Anything as crude as a human being. This is the third temptation of Christ after he had renounced the economics of turn the stones into bread and the politics of worship me and you can rule the world, Satan. People don't speak about that very often, but you know how to become a political champion by worshiping Satan. I mean, it tells you that right in the text. After having transcended economics and politics, oh, would Jesus be just so light? So the devil took him up onto the tower of Herod's palace and says, oh, you're so ethereal, just cast yourself down and God will bear you up. And Jesus says, thou shalt not tempt the Lord thy God. That's the sense of temperance. Don't go up like a balloon. Stay on the ground. But, do you know Dante's first book, the Vita Nuova, The New Life? And it's exactly about beholding Beatrice, not with lust, but with rapture, as a manifestation of God's love. And through following that rapture, he was carried to God's throne. That's the Vita Nuova, the new life, the spiritual rather than the merely physical life. That's the sense, furthermore, of the virgin birth. Virgin birth has nothing to do with the biological problem. It has to do with the birth of the spiritual life in the human animal at the level of the heart. And that's what this is. Then after that, you review the details and everything else of your life in the way of Dante going through hell, purgatory, heaven. This is the hell. There's the devil very clearly. The purgatory, the tower of destruction, the thunderbolt is a classic image for the voice of God knocking down the sinner and all of his protections. That's the sense of that. And then, finally, the light of heaven, and we pour the spiritual water out, even, and go to the transcendent. So when I saw that, I thought, well, look, there's Dante. Vita Nuova, Inferno, Purgatorio, Paradiso. Then I come down and see these four cards, cards 6, 7, 8, 9. Youth, maturity, age, old age. Justice is the virtue of age. Dante in the Convito divides life into four stages, from birth to about the age of 25, youth, the lover. And that is the dynamic of youth. Then in maturity, that image comes from Plato's Phaedo, the blue and the red horse, the earthly and the spiritual dynamic of the psyche. And the master charioteer must hold both in accord. So that's maturity. Then the justice of the virtue of age, the four virtues of age are wisdom, justice, generosity, and cheerfulness. And there's justice in the place of age. This first goes from birth to 25, then 25 to 45, then 45 to 70, and then comes old age, or Dante using a rather unfortunate word, a decrepitude, and that's the role of the hermit. So I thought, well, look at that. So then I put them down with these four, that left four between. Now we'll see how it works. Youth, maturity, age, old age. This is the chap who enters the field, and that is the one who leaves. This is the hero about to experience the adventure, and that is the one who has gone through the whole thing. Look at the hero. Do you see what he's got? He's got staves or batons, he's got coins, he's got cups, and he's got cutting objects, swords. Any one of the tracks of the four suits can lead you to the beginning of the spiritual journey. So he's about to enter the spiritual journey. He's called the magician. Now, first encounter, youth, the young woman. Oh, here, the four, and he. She's called a high priestess. Actually, for the young man, the young woman is the high priestess of his destiny. She will make the life form. And the quality of youth is always one of something in prospect. And everything one does implies a result. And if you make a small mistake, it's a big mistake further on. So youth's action is always in terms of something to come of it. And so she is a high priestess. Sometimes she's called the prophetess there. Now, of course, vice versa. If we start with the young woman, then the magician is the counterpart in her life. That's the youth. Then we come to maturity, the empress, the queen of queens, a mature woman. That's the maturity of life. And then comes an interesting one. Here is the old king, the emperor. He's facing her. white beard. He said, that's age. And then old age moves into the spiritual realm completely, leaves the earthly behind, and so we have this figure of the Pope, who is the, what might be called, worldly representative of the spiritual path. Here is entering the field, and these are the four stages: youth, maturity, age, and decrepitude. This is a tantric icon from India. It's called Mani Dvipa, the Isle of Jewels. And what it shows is Shiva and Shakti, the Lingam Yoni personified, and this other figure turning away. Shiva addressing the world, generating the world, the mind turned toward the temporal field, and here the mind turned away. And the name of that turned away figure is Shava, and Shava means corpse. A monk wears the yellow robe. The yellow robe is the color of the robe that is put on a corpse in India. This man is a corpse. Not many are behaving quite that way these days, but the two addresses of the mind. One turned away, another toward the world. So that's the king and the pope. This is the original, earliest pack we have from 1392. It was made for the King of France. So now we go up on the next plane. The lover, that's the dynamic, the energy of youth. The charioteer, controlling in maturity the two powers, spiritual and earthly powers of his life. Justice over the emperor who judges. He must judge in terms of justice, and not prejudice or anything of the kind, or personal profit. And finally, the hermit, who is actually now engaged in the spiritual life. And you see the red light? He's following the light, the color of the spirit. They match. Dante's description of the virtues of the four ages are for youth: obedience, a sense of shame, comeliness of appearance, and sweetness of conduct. I always liked presenting these to my students during the 60s. They represented exactly the reverse of every one of them. For maturity, the virtues are temperance and courage. I've named them already. Temperance, courage, love, loyalty, and courtesy. For age, wisdom, justice, this is the big thing there. Wisdom, justice, generosity, and cheerfulness. And for old age, looking back over life with gratitude, that's the key virtue here, gratitude to life, and forward to death as to a return home. I once was lecturing on this matter of the four ages of Dante's Convito, up in Eureka, is that it, in Oregon? There's a town up there, and a young woman comes up to me afterwards and said, well, this was in the 60s, of course, Dr. Campbell, you don't understand us today. We go directly from infancy to wisdom. I was a little bit surprised. But I said, you know, that's wonderful. All you've missed is life. I felt pretty good about that. Now we come to a very important one. We have given the two lower series, and now we come to the middle series, which is that of transformation.